listening to the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Each week, you'll hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Americans for Truth Hour will help you to stay informed and engaged on the side of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with us as we work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. And now, here's Peter LaBarbera.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Americans for Truth Hour. Americans for Truth is a single-minded organization devoted to opposing the homosexual activist movement. And we are talking to our friend Scott Lively, who is a longtime culture warrior on this issue. This is part three of our three-part interview. I think at some point, Scott, we will bring you back, but thanks for coming on again.
It's my pleasure.
And if you weren't listening to the first episodes, which will be available online at AmericansForTruth.org, Scott was the recipient of our annual American Truth Teller Award for his many years of service on this issue. And we had a wonderful banquet where there was this basically, if we were liberal, Scott, they'd call it a hate crime, right?
Yes, exactly.
But because we're conservative Christians, or just Christians who believe the Bible about homosexuality, there's been a real reluctance to call this a hate crime. And we don't, I'm sure you're like me, we don't really believe in the concept of hate crimes, but there's such a double standard on this.
Well, right. If we're going to have to live under this law that establishes something called hate crimes, and one of the categories of people protected under that law is a category of religion, then the law should be applied equally, and it hasn't been.
Yeah, and Scott, explain what are the purposes. Explain hate crimes. You know, the whole concept. What is it intended to do?
Well, the hate crimes. It's really a two-step process to the criminalization of Christian speech. The first step is to criminalize speech associated with some other kind of crime. So it becomes a sentencing enhancement if a person has said, you know, like you N-word or you F-word in the commission of a crime. And the second step in the two-part process is the criminalization of the speech independently, so that they get the society used to the idea that that a person's motive, you know, their hatred in their heart towards some particular group, is a reasonable basis for enhancing their sentence. And then once that's established, then the second step is just to separate it from the crime and make the speech itself criminal, because criminal speech is not protected by the First Amendment.
Now, is that kind of what occurs in Canada right now, although they don't have a First Amendment, but there is a hate speech code in Canada?
Right, and the same thing, that's what happened in Brazil also. In these other countries, they've just moved right to the second stage because they have the power to do it. Here in this country, they have to get the population ready for it. They've already done it in California, and that's they did that with the children first in the public schools. They created a category, and of course, this isn't a criminal charge, but it's part of the school policy for disciplinary action of the students, and it's a category called hate-motivated incident, and a hate-motivated incident includes any form of expression. So they, starting with the kids, now the children can be punished for simply saying something.
Like let's say they say that's so. I mean, I know a lot of homosexuals want to ban, or you know, the phrase "that's so gay," which a lot of kids use. And you know what? Why should the word "gay" only be attached? I mean, the homosexual activists stole the word "gay." It didn't used to mean what it means today. It didn't used to mean homosexuality. Why should it now be allowed to be only used in a positive light?
Right. Well, it's the adoption of the word "gay" to replace homosexual was an attempt to sanitize homosexuality in the common vocabulary, and simply the nature, the disgusting nature of homosexuality, has dirtied up the word. So now, simply naturally, children have started using this phrase, "that's so gay," essentially recognizing that they're just talking about sodomy. and it's something that's ugly and should be attached to things that are unpleasant and wrong.
Yeah.
And that's just a natural thing. Now, homosexuality was itself an attempt to sanitize sodomy. And that was in the 1800s. They invented the term homosexual to sort of create a new term that made focused attention on the medical condition. Homosexuality is a medical condition and not a moral weakness. So, you know, that became over time a dirty word, and then so they had to invent gay. There'll be something else eventually when gay is completely identified with sodomy and no longer sort of confused with the former meaning, which was carefree and happy.
Right. And,
Scott, go ahead.
Well, you know, the corruption of the language is just fascinating. We could spend all day on that. But I want to get into some of the things here. Let's give the backup in case anybody didn't hear this before. Two bricks were thrown the morning that Scott was about to appear. The Gay Liberation Network had been leading up to our banquet with all sorts of protesting rhetoric. They sent a certified letter to our keynote speaker, Dr. Erwin Lutzer from Moody Church in Chicago, saying you don't want to speak at this banquet because Scott Lively is there and he condones violence, and Peter LaBarbera condones violence because he's honoring Scott Lively. So there was all this propaganda, which we talked about before. And then the morning of the banquet, Dr. Lutzer, of course, did not capitulate to this deceitful homosexual campaign. The morning of the banquet, and two brick pavers, large patio bricks, were thrown through the doors of the Christian Liberty Academy in Arlington Heights with a note that says, "This is just a sample of what we will do if you don't shut down Scott Lively and AFTA." And if that weren't bad enough, within a couple hours, I think it was a few hours, Scott, a diatribe was posted on a left-wing website in Chicago, basically reiterating in longer form this threat of further violence if Scott Lively and AFTA are not shut down at the Christian Liberty Academy. Now, Scott, we've talked about the double standard here. Imagine if that were a homosexual church, let's say, and a conservative group did such a thing and then posted the manifesto. Could you imagine that manifesto would still be online as it is at the time of this recording, which is October 26th, more than 10 days after the event? That left-wing website with the threats is still online.
Well, yeah, they'd find the server and threaten the person who held the server with punishment. And but more than that, though, the statement would be the talk of the entire global liberal media. And this would be presented as an example of the escalating climate of hatred,
yes,
and bigotry against homosexuals. You know, that's the way they do things. It's all propaganda. It's all manipulation, and it's a complete double standard because it's been minimized. In our case, it's always maximized when anybody from the gay community suffers anything. They get a hangnail and it becomes international news.
Right. And Scott, you know, this climate of hate rhetoric, I mean, you are a victim, as am I guess, of this climate of hate that the homosexuals create. They spread their own propaganda. This idea that Scott Lively condones, and I want to get into the whole refutation of the Uganda lie told about you, but the idea that people like us support violence towards homosexuals is such a lie, and yet they keep spreading it. I suppose if you wanted to, you could sue for defamation.
Well, I could, and I've contemplated it several times. I am an attorney, being an attorney, I have much less confidence in the legal system than the average citizen does, because I know when it comes to these issues. I mean, if you're in a contract dispute with a car dealer about what the contract for your car is valid, you can trust the system for that, because the judge don't have any, you know, they have no bias on that. But when you're talking about a controversial social issue that you know, what splits the Democrats from the Republicans and the conservatives from the liberals, then there's more politics in the judiciary than there even is in the legislature. And these guys are appointed specifically because they hold a particular point of view on those things. And you cannot trust when you go into a courtroom with this kind of issue that you're going to get fairness at all. In fact, it's much more likely that that you're going to do more damage to your cause by letting a judge get his hands on it than if you just left it alone. Because once they rule against you, they can actually put into the law a new standard that works against you.
Now, isn't this what happened with David Parker? I mean, God bless him. He sued. You know, give us a short recall
of
that case.
Well, you know the Parker situation a lot better than I do.
Well, I know in the Parker situation, he was trying to get his whole purpose was let parents be warned if a pro-homosexual or inappropriate or controversial sexual lesson would be taught in school. What happened, it went all the way up to federal court, I believe, and in the federal court that ruled against him, because David Parker's own child had been exposed to, and another parent who was involved in the lawsuit had been exposed to these pro-homosexual lessons. What happened was that the judge's final ruling said basically tolerance of homosexuality is now an American value, and your only option is to homeschool your kids. So
well, that's actually a Supreme Court ruling now, and in the Texas case, Lawrence versus Texas. Justice Kennedy made that comment almost verbatim, saying that he could have ruled in a narrower fashion to strike down just the Texas law, but he said that he took the broader approach in going against all and really overthrowing Bowers versus Hardwick, which was the case that recognized the right of states to criminalize deviant sexual behavior.
Okay, Scott, let's leave it at that. We're talking to Scott Lively, whose group is Defend the Family International. His website is defendthefamily.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Americans for Truth Hour, folks. I'm talking to Scott Lively, who is the founder and president of Defend the Family International. He's also a pastor in Springfield, Massachusetts. His church is informally known as the Coffee House Church. Scott's really an amazing individual who has done so much. It's hard to even follow all his accomplishments, but he is reviled by the homosexual lobby because he dares tell the truth about homosexuality, and he hasn't swerved off it. He hasn't capitulated when criticized. And, of course, now he is the target of the most incredible, hateful propaganda. But Scott, you talked about the judges and how in our culture now it's the judiciary has been corrupted. On Friday, the Friday before our banquet, you recalled the story, the amazing story of how you had been sort of set up in a lawsuit. This is regarding Measure 9. You were the public information director of Measure 9, which was recount what that was again.
Well, it was a ballot measure that would have stopped the homosexual agenda cold in the state of Oregon by amending the state constitution. And I was the spokesman for that ballot measure campaign, which made me a prime target of the propaganda and dirty tricks. And one of the forms of dirty tricks were lawsuits. In that campaign and subsequently, I was sued four times for over $11 million. And the first one, I was very naive, and I wasn't prepared for this. I didn't take it seriously. And I got set up for a battery charge by a lesbian journalist who infiltrated our premiere showing of our campaign video based on the gay agenda video that Bill Horn had put out back in the 80s. And
so this was you had invitations, and somehow this lesbian journalist, was she a mainstream journalist or was she like a...
No, this is for a publication called Just Out Magazine.
Okay, so she was a gay journalist.
Right, she was a self-described bull dyke. That's how she described herself.
What was her name?
Catherine Stauffer. And she came into the meeting after our people had left the sign-up table. And the film had started, and everybody was back in the room, and she kind of snuck in through the door and came and just sat down and tried to pretend like she belonged there, but she obviously didn't. She was, you know, she looked like a journalist. She was wearing one of those vests, you know, like the field reporters wear and all that.
And this was a meeting that was not an open meeting. This was basically a closed meeting for supporters of Oregon Citizens Alliance. What year is this?
This is 1991.
Okay, 1991.
It could have been 92. I don't remember if it was that we filed the petition initially in 91. The election of that cycle was November 92.
Okay.
sometime in that process. I think it was in 91. But anyway, she came in. She wouldn't leave. She said, oh, I've got an invitation, which is absurd because it was for members only. They had gotten on our mailing list, and it went out to the mailing list. So she just came in. She wouldn't leave, and I gently but firmly removed her from the premises.
Okay, now how do you know this is some? This is where you were naive because everybody, the activists now, if you had been, you were doing this today, you know, you wouldn't even touch a left wing activist, right? So,
right,
so
right.
She it, wasn't it moving, and you sort of said you must leave, and what happens? You pushed her to the door, and you actually carried her over
I put one hand on her arm, and my other hand behind the small of her back, and I just pushed her to the door.
Uh-huh.
And then as when we got close to the door, she's kind of dug her heels in and couldn't move her. So I picked her up around her waist and walked over to the door, opened the door. Well, I set her down to open the door, and she crumpled on the floor, and you know, a la the nuclear protests always do, you know, the passive sort of.
Right.
And then so I stepped over. I picked her up under her arms. I just pulled her gently over the threshold, set her down. Stepped back over and closed the door and went back in, and she got up and ran off. And, you know, it's less force than is allowed under the law when you're dealing with someone who's criminally trespassing. Any bouncer would have been able to do far more. But
right.
My intention wasn't to hurt her, and I didn't hurt her.
Of course not.
But she went to the police, tried to have me arrested. They refused to do it. Because she was criminally trespassing, they told her so.
Did she admit that she was criminally trespassing?
She did to the assistant district attorney, who put it in his report, which this person conveniently refused to remember when we had the trial. So it was our ace in the hole that would have killed the whole charge. But nevertheless. She was able to file in civil court, and of course anybody can file anything in civil court. All you have to do is have the money and a lawyer who's willing to do it, and you can drag somebody through a fairly long process of harassment. As long as you get something to hang your hat on, and she had, you know, she had enough to be able to do that, because battery is all battery is an unwanted touching. That's all it is. I mean, I could poke you in the ribs, and you could sue me for battery. And that's about what this amounted to.
So now, this is leading up. She's filed this case, and you're not taking it seriously at first. And you've got her. She actually admits to the assistant district attorney that she was trespassing at your event. So what happens?
Well, they dragged it out until just before the election, because they had the whole thing set up. They had controlled the court system in Multnomah County in Oregon. They arranged for a special pro tem judge to run this hearing. He was actually a corporate lawyer for Nike, which was one of the opponents, one of the people funding our opponent's campaign. And then they had one of the judges from the Gay and Lesbian Law Association sitting in the back of the room, making sure he did what he was supposed to do. At least that's my analysis of it. And then what should have been a tiny little half a day non-issue, they bragged out for 4 days and kept it as the lead story in the news every night on the 5 o'clock news and in the papers.
With the headline being that the head of the OCA, the Oregon Citizens Alliance campaign, Measure 9, was being sued for battery. For how was it construed as beating or you know molesting a lesbian?
They misrepresented as violence, and she did allege some, but nowhere near as much as actually they did in the media. The actual case was very limited in terms of its accusations in that regard, but it was all for the purpose of discrediting the measure,
right?
The whole campaign had been equating the OCA with the Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. So this was just like one more thing. And she's presented as this brave young woman who infiltrated this hate group, like the old stories from the Southern journalists
right.
going in to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan or something. They
right.
were always making those kinds of parallels.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a setup from the beginning. And the judge, of course, prevented my attorney. This is where we were really naive. Because we didn't have very much money, and we accepted the offer of an attorney. It was for his first case out of law school, And it turned out to be far bigger than he had was ready for. And this judge just steamrolled him. And when it came to bring in the assistant district attorney's testimony that he had written in his own report that she was criminally, that would have killed the whole thing right there.
That she was criminally trespassing.
Right. You're allowed to use reasonable force to eject the trespasser.
And even if the guy was now somehow bullied by the or whatever for whatever reason he would not reiterate his testimony, you still have it in written form, but that was not allowed to be submitted.
Exactly. And there is a process for overcoming hearsay. Hearsay is an out of court statement offered to prove the matter that's asserted in the statement. And It's excluded, but there's a whole bunch of hearsay exceptions, including introducing the document itself when it's called what's called a past recollection recorded. You know, and all you do is you get the person to acknowledge that yes, it's his report, and he usually tells the truth in it. Then you can bring the document.
Right.
But it's a multi-stage process to get to that. And the judge interrupted that process and threatened my attorney with sanctions if he brought that in.
Wow.
Even in the height of drama, had the bailiff take the jury out of the room, you know, after getting all red-faced and angry. So they never even got to hear this exchange. And then my attorney backed down at the last minute and didn't press for the document to come in. So we were, to excuse the expression, we were screwed
right
at that point.
Because the testimony where this lesbian had snuck in and admitted that she was criminally trespassing was not allowed to be admitted before the jury.
Right. And, of course, the jury never even knew that what the dispute was about.
Okay, another
example of...
Well, then what happens? And so you got... Did you plea bargain or what happened?
No. Plea bargain's for a criminal case. This is a civil case.
Okay.
And it basically, you're liable in a civil case. You're not. There's not a verdict against.
Right.
You.
Okay.
You're just liable for the harm that's been done to the other party. So, she got a $22,000 judgment against me and OCA, on whose behalf I was acting, and then
now here's where the propaganda begins. The left starts its campaign commercials. This is in the month before the campaign.
About $1 million into this campaign. This is the biggest commercial of their campaign, and the centerpiece of it was my picture and a voiceover that said a lesbian is beaten by an official of the OCA, which was absolutely slanderous and defamatory on its face. But in Oregon, you have to give the media the opportunity to correct before you can sue. And so I called them and told them, look, you better pull that. And so they did, and they changed one word. And then they put it right back out the very next day. A lesbian is battered by an official of the OCA, which technically was found liable for battery. But in the public mind, battery means beating somebody up. In a legal sense, battery is just an unwanted touching. That's all it is. And like I said, just poking you in the ribs is sufficient for a charge of battery.
So let's just sum up here. So the lead up to the campaign is commercials with Scott Lively's picture like some awful criminal. A lesbian is battered by a member of the OCA. This is the kind of propaganda, deceptive tactics, dirty tricks that the other side uses, and it's just amazing, and this story needs to be told and getting out there. We're talking to Scott Lively. We'll be right back after the break.
Are you sick and tired of homosexuality and gay marriage being celebrated by the liberal media and popular culture? Do you worry about the radical gay agenda being pushed on young children in schools? Are you worried that the gay movement will destroy America's religious freedoms? And are you offended that Christians are called bigots and homophobes just because they agree with God that homosexual behavior is wrong? Americans for Truth About Homosexuality is a single-issue group devoted to exposing and fighting the gay agenda. They are not about hate, but love for God's truth. They are Christians, so instead of celebrating homosexuality, they lift up the many ex-gays who have left it behind and now lead godly lives through Christ. But Americans for Truth needs your help. The gay lobby has lots of money, power, and media support, but it lacks truth. Please help keep this show on the air and educate America about the dangerous goals of this anti-Christian movement. Make your gift online today at AmericansForTruth.com. That's AmericansForTruth.com. americansforfreedom.com.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to Americans for Truth Hour. We're talking to my friend Scott Lively, who is the recipient of the Americans for Truth 2011 American Truth Teller Award. You can find Scott Lively at defendthefamily.org. Scott just recounted this his terrible story of how he was set up as a young pro-family activist. Scott, the story you just told is pure evil. To end up at the end of a campaign with commercials, $1 million TV commercial campaign with your picture on the TV under the headline, "A Lesbian is Battered by a Member of the OCA, the Oregon Citizens Alliance, with You as the Batterer." I mean, that must just be painful just to recollect that awful story.
That was one of the low points of my life. And I really, I mean, I was just a babe in Christ, too, at the time. And I was like, you know, God, how could you have allowed this? I had complete confidence during the entire process of this that it was all going to be stopped. I mean, because I just didn't think God would ever allow because they just lied and cheated. She brought in people to testify. She brought in a lesbian chiropractor to testify that Catherine had been so badly injured she couldn't raise her arms anymore up above her shoulders. It made me want to throw up. And it was so obvious. Her mom came in and cried about how her little baby had been completely transformed and could barely recognize her anymore. And I think it was over the top to the point. That's why they only got a $22,000 judgment. They were actually going for $400,000. And I think they really thought they were going to get it. And I actually thought they were going to get it after we lost our ace in the hole. But I came to realize later that this was all for my good, and that's the reason I became an attorney myself. I never would have done it if it hadn't been for that case.
You saw the corruption, and at that point, I think you said in our previous interview, you thought you could make a lot of change yourself, but you've come to see, look, the problems in our society are so deep, the corruption is so great that even the judiciary is now not really going to save us.
Well, we no longer really have the rule of law. We have the rule of man. And the rule of man means the will of man. And the rule of law means the law above the law that rests in God.
Yeah. And Scott, you know, we face
that of generations past.
I'm sorry. Yeah, and I cut you off. But we are dealing with an evil movement. And, you know, we'll be chastised just for saying that. But, I mean, the ends justify the means. They needed to defeat Measure 9. Which you had helped craft, and Lon Mabon and Oregon Citizens Alliance, and so they used. I mean, there's no justice in the way they did anything they could. And you described before. I hope we had it in our previous interview of the fake hate crime with Azalea Cooley, 21
threats and bomb threats and mail tampering and phone tampering and dirty tricks of every kind.
They did all they could to make to try to create a fake reality that you, Scott Lively, really was like the Ku Klux Klan, which of course is all ridiculous, but this is the way they operate. Now they've stepped it up with the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, 20 years later, we're facing, you know, you and me have been accused of being hate groups analogous to the neo-Nazis and the KKK. Again, the same old tactics of the left, demonize, ostracize, and marginalize people who are just representing biblical values.
Well, the real problem, if they succeed, and I mean they're really moving very fast to accomplish everything on their agenda, is that they've been crying wolf for so long about people who aren't haters being haters that when they finally encounter the real haters, no one's going to listen to them anymore. There are people that really really hate them. And they really do want to do violence to them.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are sort of lurking on the fringes of society, waiting for the moral order to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just going to come rushing in and take revenge against everybody that made them feel bad.
Well, I mean, you could make Sharia law certainly isn't anything like the application of Christian morality. That's for sure.
Right. Well, what's really ironic is you have the gays and the Islamists working together against Christianity. The gays thinking somehow that they're achieving a utopian fantasy that's in their minds, and they're going to wake up if they succeed. They're going to wake up to the harsh reality of a sword on their neck. or concrete wall tumbled on us, or the way they killed them in Afghanistan, that they put them next to a wall and knock a wall over them.
Yeah, Sharia law saying, you know, they actually push homosexuals off a high building. I mean, yeah, it's a ridiculous alliance. But Scott, we don't have too much time. We got 7 minutes to the break of this segment. Talk about I want to get how you ended up at this inner city church, Christian Mission. It began with you being giving a tour in the former East Bloc, the Soviet Union. Talk about how that happened and how it ended up leading to the founding of the Coffee House Church.
Well, in 2006, I was running a law practice in Southern California at a private law practice, and I also ran the Pro Family Law Center, which is doing public interest cases. I received a call. Someone asked if I'd be willing to go to Latvia and speak. The head of a 250-member denomination, Russian-speaking denomination, had read the pink swastika. And he was standing up against gay marriage in Latvia, and the European media was calling him a Nazi. So he saw this book. He said, this is it. So I went to Latvia with my wife, and, here in the United States, trying to get people to come out to listen to a talk on the homosexual agenda and all that, it's like pulling teeth.
Right.
You get a dozen people. You know, you had a great turnout in your banquet. But generally speaking, it's difficult because people are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Either that or they're completely apathetic. They just don't think it's a problem or something.
Right.
But there in Latvia, there were 5,000 people. I got a standing ovation for my presentation. And then afterwards, sitting in the hospitality room with a semicircle of people around me, three deep, members of parliament, millionaire business people, all pelting me with questions about how to be able to respond to this in their country. It was like, have I died and gone to heaven? I mean, in terms of a career, in terms of this has been my ministry, and then have what one wishes would have happened in the U.S. happen there. And I said, I would really like to be part of this activist denomination. Most of their pastors, like myself, were former drug addicts and alcoholics. And they got delivered and healed in their rehab houses. And many of them would want to become pastors. So they would give them training for a few years and then send them to a city where they didn't have a church and say, go take that city for Christ. And what they meant by that was not expand our denomination. They really meant take the city for Christ. And so these people would do things that American Christians wouldn't do in a million years. They formed Christian political parties. They started businesses. They started media organizations or got into the media. And it was all for the purpose of transforming the society from the top down through the influence of the gospel. And my wife and I then did a 50-city tour through 8 countries of the former Soviet Union, visiting those churches, preaching in those churches, lecturing in the universities, meeting with government officials. It was just fantastic. It was one of the best experiences of my whole life. And in the midst of all that, I began asking the Lord, can I have a city? And long story short, he gave me Springfield, Massachusetts. And my wife and I came here in January of 2008 to start our own mission to transform Springfield, Massachusetts, and to make it a Christian city. And we bought a building that now houses our coffee shop, which is our church also. It's a church in the form of a coffee house. My wife and I bought an abandoned house in the middle of the inner city. People can go to redemptiongate.org is our website and see. You can see the house we live in. You can see what it looked like when we started. You can see the coffee house. You can see all the projects we've got going. And it's just so, and I don't deal with the homosexual issue here at all.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, if I did, that would be all I'd ever do because
right.
We're right south of Northampton, the lesbian capital of the world.
Right. But the media still razzes you for that, and they try to demonize you for your past work.
Right. They took a really good shot at us, and I think they thought they were going to push us out. It was a coordinated effort. What had happened is we took in a couple the husband was actually a sex offender, and we didn't know it. But he was now married. They had a little girl. She was 7 months pregnant, and they were about to lose their house in a week. And we were at the same time looking for a missionary couple to come in and be the kind of live-in managers of the coffee house.
He was a repentant new believer.
Right. This had been like 15 years before.
Right.
And he was a solid Christian now, but nevertheless, he hadn't revealed this. But in getting ready to move over to the building, he had gone, had to go into the Holyoke Police Department and register and make to shift his paperwork to Springfield. And my belief is that somebody inside the Holyoke Police Department knew what was going on, knew where he was going, and then set us up. And then they waited until he was had actually made the move. And then we got hit with a front page story. Not about him at first. That was a secondary thing. They hit us with a front page story on the Boston Globe, completely gratuitous, not connected with any current events or topics whatsoever. All about me coming to Springfield. The third anniversary to the day of our arrival in Springfield, and January 5th, 2011, the story came out, and it was all this massive hit piece, Uganda, all kinds of stuff, and then it was followed up 2 days later by a local story in the local paper, in which we got hit on the theme of they accused us of encouraging the high school students to be truants and hang out in the coffee house. And which actually we had kicked the kids out from smoking pot in the back and told them it's better for you to drink coffee than it is for you to be back there smoking dope. And these kids are everywhere in Springfield. And yet they specifically targeted and focused on us because they knew that because they were waiting for the third step. The third step of this attack was then to expose Michael for being a registered sex offender.
Yeah, Scott Lively hires sex offender becomes a headline.
Right. And it was like a 1-2-3. The third was supposed to be the knockout punch and to just knock us completely out.
But right. We're talking
other plans. We survived.
Hold on. Good. Hold on right there, Scott. We're talking to Scott Lively. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, folks, to the Americans for Truth Hour. Americans for Truth, in case you're interested, we need support, as does Scott. I would ask you to consider supporting both our organizations. Our website is americansfortruth.org. You can help us out using the donate page. We could use monthly givers, as could Scott. And I would just ask you to pray and consider helping us out because we are vastly underfunded compared to the huge homosexual lobby, which is really a big business now, Scott. I mean, you're talking Human Rights Campaign. The executive there makes, I mean, the CEO makes over $300,000. This is really David and Goliath, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, man. It's you know, I could be a millionaire if I stayed in California and stayed in private practice. But I gave that up to be a missionary. My wife and I are here in Springfield. We're living in the worst neighborhood of the city, in a former crack house that was all dilapidated and broken down. All the copper had been stolen out and we live on donations.
Yeah. You know,
and I run this whole organization on a shoestring. God blesses us in so many ways. I don't regret anything. But to then look out the proverbial window here, the metaphorical window, and see people like the head of the Human Rights Campaign Fund raking in these obscene amounts of money for advancing perversion.
Yeah.
You have to be a strong Christian to be able to endure that living that contrast.
Hey, Scott, we're going to have to do a fourth interview. I don't know if we'll do it next week, but because we haven't hardly talked with Scott at all about his book, The Pink Swastika, which is about the rise of the homosexual influence within Nazism. But Scott, let's leave that for the last interview, whenever that occurs. Talk as a pastor about Romans 1, the reprobate mind, what we're seeing with this astounding now growth of homosexuality in American culture.
Yes, well, I've been studying, I've been a pastor for a while now, and I've been a Christian activist for longer than I've been a pastor. But this particular year, especially with all the things that have been happening, like many Christians, I have dug into prophecy in a way that I really never had done before. And when I study something, I study it very intently. And at the end of this year of digging into this, I really believe that Romans 1, that 18 through 32, dealing with the reprobate mind and that is linked to another passage from Paul, 2 Timothy chapter 3, which says that in the last days, perilous times will come. And it says men will be lovers of selves rather than lovers of God. And it gives a whole list, laundry list of behaviors, criminal behaviors, of immoral behaviors. That's parallels the list that's at the end of Romans. And it really ties those two passages together in a way that I think indicates that the perilous times that Paul is talking about has to do with homosexuality. And that's what we're seeing around us. We've never faced, in the history of Christianity, we've really never faced as much of a threat as we do right now from the homosexual agenda globally. And I'm not the first one to say that. I mean, I've been saying it internally for a while, but the head of the Southern Baptist Convention said that last month or the month before. The Catholic priest who used to head up Human Life International has made a very similar statement. And it really seems obvious to those who have been on the front lines, who have had that overview picture of what's happening in society at large, that this issue somehow seems to be the issue of the end of the age. And it does, because it goes right to the very heart of what it means to be a human being. Our sexuality is so primal, it's so foundational to who we are in as creations of God, that's why God uses homosexuality as the exemplar of the reprobate mind in Romans 1. That a person, in order for a person to identify themselves as homosexual, they have to be able, they see the testimony of their own bodies, which is created by God, as male or female, with obviously a complementary half of one whole. And to be able to ignore that testimony in order to be able to claim an alternate identity based upon a sexual practice that is condemned by God as an abomination. Tueva, the Hebrew word tueva, the strongest word of condemnation in the Bible. And that conclusion that a person comes to, that I'm gay, is really a denial of the very essence of their sexuality as a human being, and a claim to a detestable practice. Now, I have great sympathy for people who struggle with this. I think it may be the toughest addiction that anyone can have, even more than cocaine, I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I think what people go through with homosexuality is a much tougher thing to struggle with, because at least drugs and alcohol are not part of your makeup. Yeah. Sexuality is a part of your very makeup. And when you fall into a dysfunction, a behavioral dysfunction that's the equivalent of alcoholism, but in the sexual realm, the overcoming that is compounded many times by just the nature of having hormones and, you know, being sexually aware. And so I have great sympathy, and I minister to people who struggle with this behavioral problem individually with kindness and compassion, but I stand against the movement that they have created as a truly evil institution that's goal is the destruction of Christian civilization and the replacement with some fantasy that they have in their minds about a society of egalitarian society where they're going to be able to do everything they want, and all these positive aspects of Christian civilization that they take for granted are somehow just going to continue on unimpeded.
Yeah,
it won't work. It can't work. These are contradictory worldviews.
And they're at war with the Word of God. I mean, ultimately, and that's why you see, it's incredible to see a political group like Human Rights Campaign, the leading homosexual lobby group in the world, actually doing Bible studies, Scott, to propagate this false gay philosophy, this gay theology. You got two minutes.
Heresy. It's the heresy of our time. You know, back in the first or second century, Irenaeus, you know, wrote his 5-volume set against heresies. Well, if he were alive today, he would be writing a 6th volume on gay theology, because it is a direct assault on the principles of the Bible, on the very nature of God and of human beings, and it turns everything on its head. And unfortunately, the Christian Church in the West has become so biblically illiterate that the average Christian really doesn't know how to respond to most of these arguments. They don't know the Bible very well.
Well, is that the way back, Scott? We got a minute and a half. What would you advise Christians who want to have an impact on this particular debate to do?
Well, develop a biblical worldview first, in which you decide in yourself. Every Christian should decide that they love the truth more than anything else, and that you dig in to know what you hunger and thirst to understand what the truth is. And whenever you encounter something false, in other words, something that contradicts the perspective of God, that the perspective of God is perfect. He has absolute omniscience, and his perspective is capital T truth. And so therefore, the more our minds align with the mind of God, the greater intelligence we have and the more sane we are. And in contrast, the more we depart from harmony with the mind of God, the greater the amount of insanity that exists within us. That's, what is insanity? Failure to recognize the reality as it is.
Right. Amazing, Scott. Thank you so much for coming on. And we're going to have a fourth thing so we can get into the whole pink swastika question. Thanks so much, Scott.
God bless you, Pete. Bye now.
Well, thank you, Scott. And you can reach Scott at defendthefamily.org. It's an excellent website. Also, his church, defendthefamily.com. I'm sorry, defendthefamily.com or redemptivegate.org. You can reach us at americansfortruth.org. Go back, listen to the first two interviews. God bless you, Scott.
This was the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Tune in Saturdays at 11 p.m. to hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Stay informed and engaged on the issues of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with them as they work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. The Americans for Truth Hour, Saturdays at 11 p.m. on AM 1160.